From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Back in June, before the first Democratic debate, presidential candidate Andrew Yang told CNN's Brian Stelter where he wanted to stand on the debate stage, right next to Joe Biden.
His name recognition is sky high, and mine is the opposite of sky high. So if you have me next to Joe Biden, then it's going to hopefully change that dynamic and make it so that many Americans are Googling the Asian man next to Joe Biden.
And try to find out?
Yeah, I'd be like, who's that guy?
Well, Yang didn't get his wish then, and he won't get his wish for the third Democratic debate set for next week. He'll be sandwiched between Kamala Harris and Beto O'Rourke. Biden gets squeezed between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, which tells you a lot about the current realities of the Democratic race. But let's pause for a moment and acknowledge that Andrew Yang will be on the stage at all. The entrepreneur with no governmental experience is still in this race, unlike a bevy of other Democrats with long and established political careers. So is Andrew Yang onto something with his focus on automation stealing jobs and his call for a universal basic income? This hour on Point, Andrew Yang makes his case for the White House. And you can join us. Are you a member of the so-called Yang Gang? What's your take on the idea of a universal basic income? How do you take it from concept to reality in the United States? Do you think America needs another president with no elected experience? What is your question for Andrew Yang? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Andrew Yang joins us today from New York. Andrew Yang, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So first of all, let me just ask you, you've had an interesting career in a startup in the nonprofit sector as a very short-term lawyer. At what point in time did you say to yourself, the next thing I want to do is be president of the United States?
Well, it's quite recently, actually.
Yeah. What triggered that?
Well, it was Donald Trump's victory in 2016, where I'd spent the previous 6 years running a nonprofit, Venture for America, that I'd founded that helped create thousands of jobs in places like Detroit, St. Louis, Cleveland, Birmingham, New Orleans. And I was stunned by what I saw in the rest of the country, where automation had decimated communities, had eliminated 4 million manufacturing jobs in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. And then Donald Trump won in 2016, which to me was a giant red flag. It was a stop what you're doing. We just elected a narcissist reality TV star as our president, and tens of millions of Americans were desperate enough to think that that was the right move. And to me, it was clear that this is the manifestation of this economic transformation that we're in the midst of that, for whatever reason, our politicians are not discussing. The elimination of these 4 million manufacturing jobs will now migrate to retail. And people who are listening to this are seeing Main Street stores close around them every single day, call centers, fast food, and then eventually hit truck driving. And being a trucker is the most common job in 29 states. There are 3.5 million truck drivers in the U.S. And so I had no intention of running for president at any point. My wife laughs about it because in some ways I make a lousy politician. But Trump wins. I say, okay, this is a straight automation story that we're in the third inning of the fourth industrial revolution, and no one's talking about it. We're scapegoating immigrants for problems that immigrants have next to nothing to do with. And so then when you're in that position, you say, well, how can I, one, wake up America to the fact that this is a huge transformation we're in the midst of that we need to start addressing, and two, start solving the problems in the right time frame, given that we're 5 to 10 years away from robot trucks hitting the highways. And then your list of options becomes very, very limited, where it eventually just settles on run for president and win. So then I thought, well, okay, let me do that. Well,
so really, that in terms of waking up America to our very near future with automation and trying to have an impact on it, your list of options came down to running for president? But there was no other sort of way you felt you could have an impact?
Well, if you look at I got awards and accolades for helping create thousands of jobs around the country. But if you're in the midst of the greatest transformation in the history of a $20 trillion economy and the moves you need to make are at that scale, you could go to the biggest foundations in the country, which I've worked with, And they're at the wrong scale. You know, it's like if you had $1 billion in a foundation, that means you're laying out, let's call it $50 million a year. You know, and so $50 million a year is enough for you to run a couple of pilots and put out some think papers and say, okay, like, hey, this might be a problem. Meanwhile, our communities are getting decimated. Our life expectancies declined for the last 3 years because suicides and drug overdoses have become leading causes of death, surpassing vehicle deaths. Donald Trump's our president. And unfortunately, things are about to pick up steam as artificial intelligence leaves the lab and starts hitting commercial enterprises. I just addressed a group of 70 CEOs in New York, and I asked them, how many of you are looking at having AI displace clerical workers in your back office? And guess how many hands went up out of 70?
All of them.
All of them. That's right. The truth is you could fire that CEO if they were not looking at replacing their back office workers with software. So we are in the midst of this incredible transformation, and our politicians want nothing to do with it.
So I want to talk to you, of course, in detail about your sort of list of solutions to manage the nation through this transformation. But you've already mentioned twice your previous experience with Venture for America, right? That's your nonprofit where you say you've created thousands of jobs and not having an elected record so far. We got to look to your record as an entrepreneur and a business person. Now, when Venture for America was first founded, when you first founded it, you had the idea was kind of an entrepreneurial Teach for America, right? You would get the brightest minds to go to economically depressed communities and create startups there. And you said you were going to create 100,000 jobs, right? But so far, 100,000 jobs by 2025, right? But so far, VFA has only created 3,500 jobs. So what does that record tell us about your ability to get things done?
Well, first, I'm incredibly proud of all the work that Venture for America does and continues to do. I mean, they're thriving without me. Turns out they didn't need me very much. But if anything, my work with Venture for America verified just how badly the economy is doing in terms of job creation and new business formation, and that we need to face facts that right now we pretend that the internet is this giant catalyst for entrepreneurship. Meanwhile, Amazon is closing 30% of America's stores and malls, and being a retail clerk is one of the most common jobs in the country. The average retail worker is a 39-year-old woman making between $9 and $11 an hour. Mm-hmm. So my work with Venture for America, to me, pushed me in a direction that says we need to think much, much bigger about the solutions.
Okay. And point taken on that. But I just wonder if you could, because I, you know, whenever we talk to aspiring, whenever we talk to presidential candidates, you know, one of our duties is to look at what their record tells us about what kind of leader they might be. So I'm just wondering if you could answer the question specifically. Like, the goal was to create 100,000 jobs by 2025. And thus far, this nonprofit that you've created has only created 3,500 jobs. And in fact, almost 50% of the people who have been Venture for America fellows ended up not staying in the communities that they were sort of planted in. So is that a great record of success is what I'm asking.
I mean, listen to what you're saying, really. You're saying that essentially 50% did decide to stay and that we helped create thousands of jobs in Detroit, Baltimore, Cleveland, like, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, like, it's an incredible track record that I'm you know, like, I mean, I know the people who are in these communities doing the work, and like, I'm incredibly proud of all of it. And if you go and visit with people who are working at Venture for America, you'd have the same exact sentiment.
Okay. So I guess what I'm wondering is, the reason why I asked you about that is one of the main questions that I think voters rightly have when they're looking at a slate, and like, look, the Democratic slate is still a crowded one of candidates, is they might ask themselves, okay, I'm going to listen to this person's ideas, but who's going to be able to actually get their ideas across the finish line in Washington? Do you think you're that person?
I'm definitely that person, and I'm one of only two candidates in the field that 10% or more of Donald Trump voters said that they would support, which means if I am the Democratic nominee, we will win this election, hands down. And then after we win and I'm the president, the Democrats will be so pumped that they made the right choice. I mean, it's a bit of a bet, obviously. But they'll be so pumped to have beaten Donald Trump that getting money into the hands of families and children and making our communities stronger, healthier, mentally healthier through the freedom dividend will be the first order of business. But here's the kicker, Magna. Then the Republicans will look up and say, wait a minute, am I against the dividend? The only state with a dividend right now is Alaska.
With the oil
dividend.
Which
is a deep red. Yeah, it's a deep red conservative state. It was passed by a Republican governor. And Republican people in Congress will say this is a huge win for rural areas, for red states on the interior that have gotten blasted by the automation of the manufacturing jobs. And we don't need 80% of Congress to pass the dividend. We just need a majority. The reason why Republicans and Trump voters and independents and libertarians are drawn to my campaign is that they see that I'm just a problem solver. I don't have any particular alignment, which means I'll be able to get things done in Washington that others cannot.
Okay. Well, we have a question here from Jennifer Simpson who says, how would you bridge the ideological chasm that exists in Washington?
And it's a massive problem. But again, this is one reason why I am the best candidate in 2020 is that people sense that I'm non-ideological, that the numbers don't care about what I believe, frankly. You know, self-driving trucks don't care necessarily about the feelings that we have. My ability to bridge the gap will become very, very clear to people through the 2020 race. And when I'm in Washington, I'll be able to build a broader coalition than any other president.
All right. Well, we have to take a quick break. We are talking with Andrew Yang. He's a Democratic presidential candidate. When we come back from the break, we'll talk about his idea for what he calls a freedom dividend. It would be a form of universal basic income in the United States. We'll talk about immigration. We'll talk about foreign policy. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Andrew Yang. He's a Democratic presidential candidate. He will be on the debate stage in next week's third round of Democratic debates. And his big ideas are getting America ready for the present and future when it comes to a massive economic transformation that's coming with automation. He wants to create a form of universal basic income for the United States as well, amongst other things. And actually, Andrew, let's just go straight to the calls because we've got folks who want to talk to you. So Albert is calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Albert, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Hi, Andrew. It's nice to speak to both of you. I am part of the Yang Gang, and I've been encouraging all my friends and family to look at you, Andrew. My question is, how do you plan on taking on Donald Trump's ability to frame a candidate as a diminutive person and tag them with a name like Sleepy Joe? And may I suggest that you use sarcasm and humor to frustrate him and to illustrate to the public all of his nonsense.
Thanks, Albert. Appreciate your support a great deal. You know, my team and I have been musing about what his nickname for me will be. And first, I want to point out that I'm
going to be quite an exercise.
Oh, it's fun. But first, I want to point out that I am one of the only candidates that he has not touched on Twitter. And the reason for that is that he's a bully and he knows I'm better at the internet than he is. A lot of the people online that create memes and whatnot have converted to the Yang Gang. So he hasn't touched me because he knows it's I'm not the candidate he wants to mess with. I agree with you that humor is the best antidote because the problem is that he seems like a bully. And then if you stand up and say, like, that's divisive, then, it's not very effective. So the nickname that we've come up with that we think he will use for me is Comrade Yang. Because it's a little racist, it makes me seem like a communist or something like that. And Americans can see through very, very quickly that the freedom dividend is simply capitalism where income doesn't start at zero. It's good for us. It's good for markets. It's good for consumers and businesses. So that's where we think he's going to go. But I truly am his kryptonite. He even said in a rally in West Virginia a number of months ago. He said he can't wait to run against the Democrats. The only thing he's worried about is that some new figure comes out of nowhere. And I'm that figure. You know, like, he runs most effectively against people that are part of the D.C. establishment, and I am not that.
Interesting, because if I may, I is it also possible that he hasn't come up with a name for you because he hasn't noticed that you're there? And I say
I say that with all due respect.
Yeah. I mean, look.
No, trust me. He knows.
I mean, he's the president is. I mean, this is my roundabout way of getting to the question of, yes, you're going to be on that debate stage, unlike several other career politicians who've dropped out of the race. But, you know, thus far, roughly a little more than 60% of the polling, or 60% of Democrats say that they're focused on Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders, and you're at 3%. So there's still a vast chasm in terms of the attention that you're able to get from a lot of Democrats. How do you want to bridge that chasm?
Well, you hit the nail on the head, Meghna, that many people are just now tuning in, where the figures you named have obviously been in the public sphere for a long time, and I'm new. So the more people like Albert who find out about me and this campaign and how we can actually build a future that improves our lives, the stronger we get, we're pulling in people from, frankly, each of the candidates you just named. We're one of really a very small handful of campaigns that has had positive momentum at every step of the way. We're going to grow and grow and grow and peak at the right time. Most Americans are not paying much attention to the election right now.
Fair enough, because it's still a really long ways away. Okay, Andrew, so let's dig into one of your core ideas. You call it the freedom dividend. It's a universal basic income idea. You would get $1,000 a month to Americans. How does this so-called freedom dividend work?
Well, first, let me share the history, which is that I know it seems far out to some people. It's like $1,000 a month. That seems impossible. But Thomas Paine was for this at the founding of the country. He called it the citizen's dividend. Martin Luther King fought for it and championed it in the 60s in his book Chaos or Community. And it is what he was fighting for when he was assassinated in 1968. He called it the guaranteed minimum income. 1,000 economists, including Milton Friedman, endorsed it in the 60s and 70s, and it was so mainstream it passed the U.S. House of Representatives twice in 1971 under Richard Nixon. It's called the Family Assistance Plan.
Friedman even called it a negative income tax.
Yeah, and Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, just came out and said, we should declare a national emergency around how the economy is not working for people and pass a negative income tax, which is essentially the sibling to my freedom dividend. So this is not Andrew Yang, crazy futurist. this is baked into America's DNA. It's inevitable, and we need to get with the program and pass it so that we can actually start focusing on the real problems of this age instead of having 78% of Americans living paycheck to paycheck and almost half can't afford an unexpected $500 bill, which ends up spreading this mindset of scarcity that makes it very, very difficult for us to come together and solve bigger problems like climate change. Studies have shown that if you can't pay your bills, it has the effect of occupying your mental bandwidth to a point that it decreases your functional IQ by 13 points or one standard deviation. So if people listening to this have the sneaking feeling that America is getting less rational, less reasonable, less optimistic, even more xenophobic, we are. Because if you introduce pervasive financial insecurity into a society, those are all the things that happen. And the way to reverse this is by getting the boot off of our throats and passing a freedom dividend or a negative income tax or a universal basic income, whatever you want to call it. But this is the flagship proposal behind my campaign. And one reason why we're doing so well is that it becomes very obvious as soon as you start to dig in and reflect on it.
But the cost of this freedom dividend would be what? In the trillions of dollars? And where would the revenue come to pay for it?
Well, a study just came out that said that our data is more valuable than oil. And if you're listening to this, do you remember getting your data check in the mail? I certainly don't. You have Amazon, this trillion-dollar tech company that's closing 30% of our stores, paying literally zero in taxes, less than everyone listening to this. Think about that for a second. $1 trillion company, zero in taxes. So then if you look up and say, how are you going to pay for it? Of course you're going to have a hard time paying for it if Amazon's paying zero back into our society. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is we need to give every American our tiny, tiny slice of every Amazon sale, every Google search, every Facebook ad, every robot truck mile. This would generate hundreds of billions in new revenue and pay for this freedom dividend in large part because the money does not disappear in our hands. We end up spending it in our local communities on car repairs and daycare and Little League signups, and it ends up creating hundreds of thousands of jobs where we live and work. This is the trickle-up economy from our people, our families, and our communities up.
Well, so giving everyone a little tiny slice of an Amazon sales, that sounds like are you talking about a value-added tax on sales?
Yeah, well, we're one of the only developed countries in the world that has not figured out that having a company like Amazon pay zero taxes is a bad idea. And it's in large part because our government has been captured by corporate lobbying interests, and they've managed to somehow rig the system that's possible, which is not the case in other developed countries. So, yeah, if you have something like a value-added tax on the Amazons of the world, then you wind up curbing this inefficiency.
Don't consumers sometimes end up bearing the brunt of the cost of a value-added tax, right? Because, like when I buy from Amazon, I'd be paying the VAT.
Which is one reason why it's so important that we have this dividend, so that for any money you're spending into the Amazons of the world, that you're getting that and then some. My plan would increase the buying power for 94% of Americans, and the 6% it would not are doing very, very well.
I gotcha. But I've also read that the benefits that people are already receiving, some folks, of government assistance in the form of SNAP benefits or housing benefits, that would be taken out of the $1,000 a month that they would receive under your freedom dividend?
Well, the last thing we want to do is take anything away from anyone. I mean, you can tell I'm trying to make the economy work for people, which is the way it should be. So the freedom dividend is opt-in. We're not taking anything away from anyone. But if you do decide to opt in, then you would be foregoing certain cash-like benefits. But when I've talked to folks who are on SNAP or on these other programs, most of them would vastly prefer unconditional cash with no case management, no reporting requirements. A lot of them are incredibly frustrated by the bureaucracy that's associated with the benefits, and they live in fear that they're going to be taken away.
Okay, let's go to Andrew, who's calling from Fort Rucker, Alabama. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? You answered a couple of my questions just while I was listening, but I do have one, sir. I read the study that was conducted in Lower Mississippi or wherever, where they gave, you know, it was just a nonprofit company gave $1,000 per month to low income families or single mothers and whatnot. And for the most part, they were in the same position as they were at the end than they were in the beginning. They either blew all their money, they just spent it on hair, or just went out and bought a bunch of stuff and didn't actually use it to the best of their potential. I know that not everybody in America is going to do this to where they just blow $1,000 a month. Like me, I'd put it towards like kids' college because, you know, I got two kids.
Me too.
So what is the actual the benefit of giving people $1,000 more per month when they, you know, don't get like necessarily not training, but education on how to invest it properly or anything? Uh-huh. You're just throwing $1,000 at people thinking it's going to, you know, make some of their issues disappear, whatnot, when it's not being used responsibly or wisely.
Andrew, thank you for your call. So, Andrew Yang, what do you think?
Yeah, so I'd say a few things. First of all, if you look at what's happened in Mississippi and virtually every other basic income study, you've seen the benefits that include better health, mental health, stress levels, relationships, optimism, decision-making, all of those things tend to go up, and that includes in the Mississippi study. The second thing is that we should be teaching financial literacy at the high school level. It should be required. The issue, and people who are listening to this know what I mean here, It's almost impossible. I would say it is impossible to teach financial literacy to someone who does not have any money. Because when you're a student listening to these lessons and you don't have any money, you're like, okay, high value of money, I got you, savings.
The magic of compounding interest. Yeah, I get
yeah,
it.
Yeah, none of it matters to you at all until you actually have a couple bucks you can rub together and then you put some. Now, you should definitely be forming mechanisms that encourage or even require savings from early on so people can learn these principles. But it's almost impossible to teach the principles in the abstract if it's not real. So my plan is to have financial literacy taught at the high school level, and then you get this dividend, and then all of a sudden you'll see your population yeah. become much more savvy financially. But the third thing is that when a company like Microsoft or Coca-Cola or Verizon returns money to shareholders, you never hear them say, we have to make sure the shareholders spend the money wisely. it's never a concern because it's their money. And the same is true here in America. We are the owners and shareholders of this democracy. It is our money. And if you take your money and buy a big TV with it, you know, in January, you know, that's your choice. You'll do something different in February. Like, it's not yeah. for me to somehow say that, you know, that like that TV was like the right or wrong move. I mean, so, I happen to like TVs, so that actually sounds like a pretty good move because, you know, I like to watch sports.
Andrew, let me ask you the question that that sparked in my mind by our caller, Andrew. Because, I mean, your idea for universal basic income emerges from your concern about what automation is doing to jobs in America. That's clear. And there was this study in Finland, a two-year period where they provided a universal basic income of like $600 a month to some 2,000 Finns who were jobless. And as you said, absolutely. One of the early findings that came out of this study was that health and well-being, happiness and well-being increased. That was a clear finding. But what didn't increase were jobs, was employment. So what I'm wondering is, what does universal basic income do for the deep foundational structural problem of losing jobs in America? Does it do anything to help people get trained and educated for the kinds of jobs that will be available in a world of automation? I'm not hearing that.
So I'll say two things. The first thing is, if you dig into the efficacy of government-funded retraining programs, they are almost entirely ineffective. If you look at the manufacturing workers in the Midwest who are eligible for retraining, the success rates of the federally funded programs were literally between 0 and 15%. Half of those workers left the workforce forever, and half of that group then filed for disability. And you then saw surges in suicides and drug overdoses in those populations. So politicians have to stop overselling retraining programs that really have, frankly, no evidence behind them. So you can't run around saying we're going to retrain the truck drivers to become coders or whatnot. Like, it's irresponsible and totally false. The second big thing is that if you were to take a town of 10,000 people, and I'm president, we pass the freedom dividend, there's another $10 million a month in that community. That ends up creating jobs at the local daycare, the local bars and restaurants, the local mechanic, the local nonprofits. It's a giant catalyst for arts, culture, creativity, volunteerism. The problem with, the study in Mississippi where you say, oh, like work levels didn't go up. Of course they didn't go up. Why would you expect them to go up if you gave 30 families like, you know, 600 or 1,000? But if you take it community wide, then all of a sudden there are massive second order economic benefits because you're supercharging that local economy, and then a ton of work gets created that actually matches up with the values of that community. You wouldn't expect it if you're running trials in like the tens, but you would expect it when you run trials in the thousands.
But do those jobs match the security and the professionalism, the dignity of the kind of work that's being lost? I mean, you mentioned in one of the Democratic debates in Detroit about all those car manufacturing jobs that have been wiped away. Is increasing childcare workers in Detroit going to balance out the community and economic loss of great paying manufacturing jobs?
Well, this is, to me, the fundamental challenge of our time, is what does the future of work look like? And the first big foundational step is to separate economic value and human value and say, look, just because your manufacturing job disappeared does not mean all of a sudden you have zero value, that your value is independent of that.
Right. There's the question of the dignity of work, which I think is on the minds of a lot of people as well, as automation doesn't just threaten blue-collar work, but white-collar work, jobs of all kinds. I mean, I'm thinking about the future where I'm not going to be needed and a computer's going to do all the talking. But Andrew Yang, stand by here for just a second. We are talking with Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang. We have been talking a lot about his idea for a universal basic income in the United States, but as he is running for president of the United States, we want to know what your questions are for him on foreign policy, on trade, on health care, on immigration as well. Let's go to Jennifer, who's calling from Beaver Creek, Ohio. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi. So my 16-year-old has been a huge fan of yours, Andrew, since April, and loves your proactive thinking and gives him hope for the future, and converted my husband and I to be part of the Yang Gang as well.
Fantastic.
But my question for you, is I have three kids, and what careers would you encourage kids to pursue in light of automation?
Well, thank you so much for the support. And one of the things I want to call out is that my wife's at home with our two boys, one of whom is autistic. And right now, her work is not considered a job, is not considered to have any economic value. And we know that's perverse. We know that the work she's doing is among the most challenging and vital that anyone does. It's one reason why I'm so passionate about something that separates our current economic value as it's measured and our human value, where a freedom dividend would start to recognize the work that my wife and other parents are doing, caregivers, nurturers around the country. Now, I'm a parent too. I've got two kids. And I think here's some good news. The studies show that between 25 and 44% of American jobs will be subject to automation in the next 20 to 30 years. Now, that's a disaster at a catastrophic level for society. But that does mean that, let's say, 60% of jobs will be here for the long term. And the jobs that will be here for the long term are non-repetitive manual jobs and non-repetitive cognitive jobs. So a repetitive cognitive job is something like being an accountant or a pharmacist or a radiologist. That's very, very rules-based. You can actually automate away a lot of that. So the other stuff that you cannot automate away are the jobs that require teamwork, sales, creativity, interpersonal skills, and relationship building. And so if your children are social, you should be pushing that. Like, it's not like, stop being social, like learn this other stuff. So the social skills will actually become integral. You should encourage your kids to do something they actually really like. And I know that sounds sort of trite, but the fact is that they like it. They're likely to actually develop individual proficiencies that are going to be harder to automate. Mm. Also, non-repetitive manual jobs includes things like plumbing and HVAC repair. Can you imagine what it would take to make a robot plumber? Almost impossible. It's going to be a human plumber for a long time. So we need to be investing in vocational training for as many of our young people as possible. Right now, only 6% of American high school students are in vocational or apprenticeship training. In Germany, that's 59%. So think about that gulf.
Yeah.
And there are millions of American jobs that require that training that we don't have workers for right now. So that's the advice I'd give. There is good news. We're not going to get rid of all the jobs. Just think non-repetitive manual or non-repetitive cognitive.
Well, let's go to Aaron, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hello there. So I wanted to ask about Mr. Yang's foreign policy ideas. We have a president that has kind of embarrassed us on the international stage, has made enemies of many of our friends. And I'm wondering what Mr. Yang would do to build better relationships with entities like the EU, Canada, China, and India.
Well, they say that the opposite of Donald Trump is an Asian man who likes math. And
you
when it comes
that.
To foreign policy, I didn't say it, Well, where it comes to foreign policy, I'm essentially Donald Trump's polar opposite, where I would rebuild our partnerships and alliances, invest in diplomacy. I've already signed a pledge to end the forever wars. We need to stop this perpetual state of armed conflict that we've been in for 18 years and counting. And our allies would find that we become, again, a reliable partner because there's a massive return on effective diplomacy. There's a massive cost to this haphazard, arbitrary unreliability that President Trump has unfortunately represented over the past number of years.
Well, so from specifically regarding foreign policy, what about China? Because all the things we've been talking about the internal transformation of the U.S. economy have a lot to do with the similar transformation globally led by China. How would you approach U.S.-China relations?
I think Donald Trump recently just said, maybe yesterday, that that he's willing to hurt the American economy if it hurts China. And I think that is the exact wrong approach, where we have to be safeguarding American interests, both in terms of individual workers and our businesses and exporters. The single biggest problem to me in the relationship from our perspective is their piracy of our intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the to me where all of our efforts should be directed on an economic basis. I had a friend who visited China, and he said he saw $10,000 worth of pirated software on every Chinese employee's desktop. And he said that's insane. Like it's think about that economic loss to our companies, but also it makes it harder to compete against those workers because it's not like the American worker gets the same software access. So that to me is the biggest problem, and that's where all of our efforts should be.
Yeah, so can I just
focused.
Jump in on that? Because, I mean, on this point, the Trump administration through the Trump Justice Department and some of its trade tools has been going after this exact issue on intellectual property theft. Do you think they're doing the right thing?
That is the right issue to focus on. The problem, though, is that to me the tariffs are an overly blunt, over-inclusive tool and ends up incurring costs on both sides. I mean, I was just in Iowa and there are farmers that feel very betrayed because they supported Donald Trump. And so you have to say, it's like, you know, should that farmer be bearing the brunt of the fact that these Chinese practices have been going on? I would say that's not the right the right victim, if you will.
Yeah. So I heard you say that you would end, as you refer to them, America's forever wars, Afghanistan being sort of chief amongst them. What about other aspects of military involvement or support around the globe? I'm thinking, for example, the United States and its role in what's happening in Yemen, right? Where we're supporting the U.S. is supporting its Saudi allies in this terrible war going on in Yemen. What would you do there?
Yeah, Yemen has degenerated because there's this proxy war going on and the U.S. is involved through supporting the Saudis. I would pull back from supporting the Saudis in that arena. I mean, it to me, I have a three-part test in terms of our armed involvement, and though in Yemen we're not actually, we don't have troops on the ground in that way. But number one, it has to serve a vital American national interest or be averting a humanitarian disaster. Number two, there has to be a defined timeline. And number three, we need to have our allies engaged and involved. And to me, we should not be supporting the Saudis in Yemen.
Well, we are talking with Andrew Yang this hour. What's your question for the Democratic presidential candidate? Aaron is calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Aaron, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you making the comment that, you know, the interests have to serve the vital interest of the American people. My question is about organized labor and having an organized voice. There's been an attack for generations now, or for decades, against organized labor by the elite. And I think collectively, working families have lost their voice that a union would provide to them, even on issues that affect local school districts and school boards. So basically, my question is, what is your position on collectively supporting and rebuilding working families to have a collective voice through organized labor and have the ability to have, to have a legitimate say-so, because their voice has been replaced with a purchased voice by the elite or by corporation.
Aaron, let me just take the call back from you. Thank you so much. So, Andrew Yang, your view on organized labor.
He's 100% correct that unions have gotten absolutely decimated over the last number of years and decades, where only 10% of American workers and 7% of private sector employees are in a union. This is down from literally 30% plus in the 40s. And so the unions have lost their voice. And one way to empower unions and workers generally is through a freedom dividend of $1,000 a month that makes workers much harder to exploit, because if you're truly getting exploited, then you can actually go home and survive. And number two, it makes organized labor much more able to negotiate meaningfully, because their members also aren't relying upon their income month to month to make ends meet. And I know this because one of the massive proponents of the freedom dividend is a guy named Andy Stern, who used to be the most powerful labor union leader in the country. And he said, the future of labor is no labor, and we need to start moving in a bigger direction. But this freedom dividend would empower workers in unions and not in unions to be able to more meaningfully negotiate.
Mm. Well, let's go to Nate, who's calling from Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Nate, you're on the air.
Hi, Andrew. I'm a huge fan. I have one question for you, though. One thing that you actually share with Donald Trump is that you have no prior political experience. I think that we see that Trump himself is often stymied by this and is not very effective. How would you be different?
Well, I'm not someone who says you need to run government like a business, because they're very, very different things, and they require different leadership practices and skills. Running the government would be much more similar to running a national nonprofit, where you set a vision, you build consensus, you try and rally people around your priorities and goals, but you don't have some sort of command and control authority. So one of the things that I would need to do is build an effective team that has significant relationships and legislative experience on Capitol Hill. And people would find that I'm able to assemble a world-class team because I'm very egoless. I like to empower people. I love to build world-class teams, and we already have people in Washington who are looking at helping us build the administration out. So I'm not some, frankly, irrational, egocentric type who's like, oh, like I can fix things. That's not the way teams work.
So let me ask you more about that, Andrew, because this is really interesting. Because the one place you would have, I suppose by definition, command and control authority is as commander-in-chief of the United States. So what would your approach be to the United States military?
Well, you need to have the right team of advisors and leaders around you, and you want to be able to trust in their judgment. But the judgment and restraint that America is looking for, I believe, in foreign policy, I've articulated through a series of commitments where I think, again, Americans do not want to be in a perpetual state of armed conflict. I have a clear set of guidelines in terms of when we would be engaged. So I think that's my job, is setting a vision for the military. But then I need to have effective military leaders that I can rely upon.
Hmm. Well, let's go to Patrick, who's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Patrick, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hello, Mr. Yang. I'm very curious about everything that you've been talking about. Glad that your points are getting out there. They're awesome. I have one, though, about gun control. I live in the country. I guess I consider myself middle of the road. I'm not totally against gun rights, but where I live, it takes quite a long time to get any help, and I've had actual violent threats against my life and feel the need to protect myself with the firearm. So what's your vision for our gun rights future?
Well, I'm sorry that you feel like you're being threatened in that way. I mean, that shouldn't be happening to anybody. I think that most of the country right now is aligned on common sense gun safety laws like universal background checks and red flag laws, and the fact that military-style assault weapons should not be out there in civilian hands all the time for people to be able to buy at like their local hardware store, Walmart, or, you know, sporting goods store. So that's where I am. I've got two young kids, and the fact that they're showing up to school and may have to go through active shooter drills strikes me as unthinkable. And we're at this point in this country, unfortunately, where people are living the unthinkable all the time in much more tragic fashion than drills. So I think we need to try and get our arms around this problem. But the brutal truth is that there are almost 400 million firearms in this country right now, more than one for every man, woman, and child, and that whatever law we pass is not going to make that supply disappear. So we need to have a perpetual buyback so that if people want to trade in their guns, that they can do so. And we need to try and make the supply of guns safer through innovations like signature guns so that only the owner can fire the gun. And then if their kid gets a hold of it, then it's just a prop.
Mm. So, Andrew Yang, we've just got a minute and a half left to go here. And there's one last question I wanted to ask you, and it has to do with what I personally thought was one of your great moments in one of the recent debates. And it's when you sort of called out the whole theater of presidential debates, and you said that folks were just talking about the fact that you weren't wearing a tie and that you were up there. Everyone was up there on the on stage with their with makeup and the rehearsed attack lines, and you said playing roles in what you called a reality TV show. I mean, I was nodding my head. I'm like, yes, there's a lot of theater around Democratic presidential debates. Period. But there's a lot of theater around campaigning as a whole, right? I mean, like, you go from place to place, you meet people, you take pictures, you give the same stump speech, et cetera, et cetera. How are you enjoying – are you enjoying campaigning or not?
Maybe because I've only been at this for a little while, but I'm having a blast. And if you want proof of that – I'll be in Manchester, New Hampshire this Saturday for a live event rally at 7 a.m. and then a pizza party at 11 a.m. But maybe because I haven't been doing this for years on end, I'm just enjoying meeting tons of Americans and helping hopefully try and solve their problems.
Well, Andrew Yang is a Democratic presidential candidate. He is amongst the 10 candidates who made the cut for next week's Democratic debate in Houston, Texas. Andrew Yang, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Meghna. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.